Welcome to episode 21 of Paper Talk, a monthly series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking. I'm Helen Hebert, and today I'm talking with Priscilla Robinson, an artist who divides her time between studios in Austin, Texas, and Taos, New Mexico. In the early 1980s, she began working with handmade paper when she was exhibiting abstract paintings in Santa Fe. Her work has been shown internationally. She exhibits regularly in national and international galleries, and she has created commissions for Boston University, Chevron, Vanderbilt University, and Kaiser Permanente, to name a few.
Hi, it's Helen Hebert with Paper Talk, and I'm in Austin, Texas, in the studio of Priscilla Robinson. It is October 24th, 2017, and a beautiful fall day here. Hi, Priscilla.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Oh, I'm glad you're here.
Yeah,
love
it's
to
great
show off
to
my
be
studio.
Here. Yeah, this is a fantastic space. So let's start just talking about your background and how you got interested in paper.
I've always been an artist, mm-hmm. ever since I can remember. And I was taught how to make handmade paper in 1982. I was exhibiting contemporary canvases in Santa Fe at the time.
Okay.
And had been for several years. And at that time, there were only two or three contemporary galleries in Santa Fe, believe it or not.
Wow.
But I was in a warehouse. I had a studio in a warehouse with about 20 other artists. And there was a man who was a bookbinder and conservator. And he had been in New York City and been part of the Andy Warhol scene and learned to make paper, how to make paper from Douglas Howell.
Oh.
And so I learned how to make paper with Jim Tapley. And I kept on. At that time, I was playing around with lots of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the other techniques and methods I left, but I would always go back to paper because it made me relax.
Mm-hmm.
It was tactile. It's just a pleasant experience. And as the years evolved, I think it was 10 years before I started meeting other paper artists.
Okay.
Which
so
was
how,
good.
So in the beginning, how were you making the paper? How sophisticated?
I was making it with blenders.
Uh-huh.
And I used a blenders for like 10 years, and I was pigmenting the pulp at that point and making them into collages.
And what was the fiber you were using?
That was just cotton. I didn't even know about abaca until
right.
quite a bit later. But it was a good way to learn
uh-huh.
because I got to develop my own style.
Right.
Instead of taking workshops or being influenced by other people,
mm-hmm.
I sort of just, you know, hit and miss. And then I was finally, like I said, after about 10 years, ready to interact with other people.
Uh-huh.
So
how did you discover other people?
Actually, there was someone here in Austin who was a member of Friends of Dart Hunter
uh-huh.
and a member of IAPMA.
Okay.
So I went to my first IAPMA conference, I think it was in about 90, 91, it was in Montreal.
Okay.
And I've tried to go to every single one since then because that is where I've learned a tremendous amount.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Okay, and so let's just talk about Santa Fe, Austin, Taos now, so... You live both places? Or?
Oh, I live in mainly here,
in Austin.
I
okay.
also have a house and studio in Taos.
Okay.
And that evolved because, like I said, I used to do all sorts of different kinds of work. But for about 10 or 15 years, I was into plein air drawings where I made my own pastels
mm.
and did them on my own paper or commercial paper.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to travel.
Mm.
And I, for several years, had been doing a Rio Grande series.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a lot of time in Big Bend. And I'd follow, do a series of drawings from Big Bend up actually the headwaters of the Rio Grande is in South Central Colorado. Okay. And so I was a backpacker then, and I found all my drawings turned out fabulous in Taos. And so eventually I bought a little fixer-upper, and after about, that was in the late 80s. Uh-huh. And then by 95, I realized the tiny bedroom wasn't going to hack it for what I wanted to do. So I built a studio. I was very actively trying to show my work and sell it. And I built a studio in 95. It's about the same size as this, but it's on the same, it's right next to the house. Mm-hmm. It's not connected, but next to it. And the strangest thing was when I built that studio and had all those wonderful windows looking out over the mountains and the sagebrush, I no longer wanted to do any plein air drawings. All I wanted to do was work with paper.
Interesting.
You know, so I feel that all the things I learned by closely observing nature, I've been really interested in the big panorama. Uh-huh. And I felt like I wanted to go more inward with the paper. And so I've been just doing paper since then, 95.
Okay.
Fully, you know, before I was going back and forth doing both of it, you know, things. So.
Let's talk about some of the techniques you're using and have developed for your works, and then also your how you get your work out there.
Okay. Techniques is what's always fascinated me with paper is its absorbency and the fact that it when it it dries, you can have created patterns and textures in that surface. And if you re-wet it, when it dries again, it will go back to that same texture you created or cast. So I just find that magical. I love that. So the technique for quite a long time has been to make cast paper on textured panels. Templates, I call them, and often with a nature motif of leaves or water. And then after they've completely dried, I put the textures on a sheet of plastic on my floor here.
So wait, let's back up. So you're actually making sheets of paper.
I make sheets of paper, and then I couch them on a template. Let them dry.
You couch them right on there.
I couch them directly.
Onto an embossed template surface.
Right.
Okay.
And for a while I was calling them embossed, but they're really not embossed because they never dry flat. They dry on that texture.
Right.
And that is what allows me when I come back and add watered down acrylic to them, because early on I decided I didn't like the pigment in the pulp. I thought it was more beautiful. Adding watered down acrylic.
So you're couching the sheets onto these textured surfaces that you've created as well.
I create them out of gator core that I cut up. I make patterns with glue gun. One favorite one is I'll glue bumpers onto a panel.
What do you mean bumpers?
Like, you know, on the backs of a picture frame.
Oh, okay.
So I bought like 500 bumpers and made a pattern, and it makes fabulous sort of little dots, you know. There's lots of ways to make dots, glue guns, cut out circles. You know, I must have over the years 50 templates. And then another great way of making templates is with a Dremel drill. Insulation foam, you can get an 8x10 sheet of insulation foam for like $10. And then but you have to go outside and do it. You take a Dremel drill and it will chip away.
Right.
And make little cavities and patterns so you can create fabulous textures that way.
Right.
Of course, one's an Audi and one's
right.
an Innie.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And I like, in the final effect, I like the contrast of doing mm-hmm. the Audis and mm-hmm. the Innies of the casting. And so I create, you know, lots and lots of textures and...
And so I just want to go through the process. So then, so you're cooching right onto these templates,
uh-huh.
and then they take a day to dry.
It depends on
day
how
to
humid
two.
It
yeah.
is, and I'll line the studio up where it's just almost like a bookshelf, and you know, layers of wood. I have fans going,
right.
dehumidifier
right.
going. I'm always waiting for things to dry because then when they're dry and then I paint them, I have to turn around and wait for them
to dry
the paint
again.
To dry again. So I'm waiting a lot.
And are you, I'm just curious about your thinking process. Are you just making a bunch of papers that will eventually become something? Are you making intentionally for a piece usually?
Usually I am making it for a commission.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because early on I realized I had to figure out, well, first of all, how I was going to have a place to work in,
mm-hmm.
which meant I had to make some money somehow.
Mm-hmm.
It was either by selling the art or teaching.
Right.
And in the early days, well, immediately, the first thing I was doing is I was approaching galleries. This was like... I think my first gallery was in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
But I also always had the philosophy, don't ever put everything, in,
right.
all your eggs in one
mm-hmm.
basket. And as time evolved, and it happened just sort of, you know, by serendipity, but there was a woman who I was working with who had a gallery, and she remarried and moved and realized the way she could make money would become... an art consultant.
Uh-huh.
And in the 80s, that was not very common. Now,
yeah.
that is
a business.
A very big... So we learned together, and then she had other art consultant friends that I developed relationships with them. So I found it very, very important to have good relationships with people who sell art, whether
yes.
they own galleries... or art consultants.
Uh-huh.
And that means there's not much time left over for between doing the work and having relationships. But in the early days, I spent a lot of time developing those relationships.
Sure.
Now a lot of us are old friends. A lot of them have retired.
Uh-huh.
They've sold their businesses on to other people. So they're younger. And in one case, I'm on a third level of... A relationship that started like 30 years ago and keeps on evolving. So
wow. Yeah. How many different consultants are you looking
for? Well, okay. A consultant is not a gallery.
Right.
Okay. A consultant works for the client.
Yes.
Not for the artist.
Mm-hmm.
An art consultant will get hired by an architect or someone who's just built a huge building.
Mm-hmm.
And they are looking for a certain kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
So as an artist, you want to make sure as many art consultants know what you do. And so they think of you when they come into a
right.
certain kind of circumstance and a certain kind of client.
Mm-hmm.
So we started this on how I make the paper. Often, I am... And usually I'm given a size and a color palette. I actually find that invigorating.
Mm-hmm.
I know some artists find that restrictive
mm-hmm.
and some styles
mm-hmm.
that would be restrictive too. But for me, it's just sort of a great way to start. And I also have gotten good ideas that my mind might not have come up with.
By having those parameters.
But
yeah.
with those parameters, like some strange colors.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'd never worked with that color, but hey, let's do it. It's really great, you know, to have an external vague parameter to be creative within that.
Okay. Right, right.
So I'm often, you know, leaves in water. I mean, people often are gravitating toward my handmade paper work because it has an organic sense to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's different. It's not quite a painting, but it's not quite a textile. It's not quite, a weaving.
Right.
And I have learned that's also where I feel my most successful work is.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
It's been a good symbiosis.
Right, right. Okay, so let's weave back to the process again and the techniques. So you have all the papers that you take off of the panels, and then you're also casting papers over forms like egg shapes, cone shapes, and we talked earlier a little bit about units.
So units.
You work in units. And then the paint. Let's come back to how you add the color.
Okay, well, so early on in the late 90s, I started casting circles, mm-hmm. handmade paper circles mm-hmm. with textures on them. And I realized if I cut them in half, they were a wonderful abstract butterfly.
Mm.
And then if I mounted them in a way where they opened up like a book,
mm-hmm.
They were very visually interesting and very different.
Right.
So if I added, like, you know, lots of these half circles together in a grouping, in a grid, I could create these wonderful combinations. And then I had to experiment with different kinds of fibers. You know, mm-hmm. The early ones were the cast abaca mm-hmm. with the texture. Then I found when I was working with Kozo, if I did maybe 18 layers of very sheer Kozo, mm-hmm. the same unit shape put together had a totally different look, uh-huh. but it was really fascinating. So then what happens if you do with little rectangles the same uh-huh. thing, uh-huh. you know? And then how about triangles?
Right.
You know, so cast triangles, cast small triangles, cast big triangles, mm-hmm. you know, cast it with textures, cast it with Kozo or heavily beaten flax. Each time I'd get a different effect, and it was really exciting to see what would happen. In the last couple of years, I've gotten interested and been thinking more of pixels, maybe because I'm spending more time with Adobe Photoshop on my computer. But so my units have gotten smaller,
right.
and they've been circular.
Uh-huh.
So for a couple of years, I've been interested in rolling my painted papers into like little sushi rolls. And I've developed, you know, certain heights I want it to be and ways to make color combinations. And then just lately, it occurred to me, it's still circular and still thinking of pixels,
mm-hmm.
is what if I cast curved shapes, mm-hmm. basically little tiny Easter eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to go on to Amazon and I ordered, you know, three or four different sizes, cast my heavily beaten abaca on that. And I like the fact that it goes back to the same principle of my textured panels, where it works because paper wants to go back to the shape it dried in the very first time. Mm-hmm. So now I can get these cast Easter eggs off the egg by simply re-wetting them, letting the fiber relax, letting them go back and dry back to the shape of the egg.
Right, and we're sitting here. I'll post a photo in the show notes surrounded by a bunch of cast Easter eggs. Sitting in little cups so they don't roll over the place.
Right, so they don't roll over. And then I realized cones work too.
Uh-huh.
So I'm making cones, And I'm doing all this paper because I'm going to be doing the drive up to Taos tomorrow. So I don't have a beater.
Right.
I usually always make the paper here because that's where most of my paper equipment is here in mm-hmm. Austin. And it gives me goals and deadlines,
uh-huh.
you know, and it's been, well, I've been doing this for, what, 27, 28 years, and I find it very creative to work uh-huh. this way.
Uh-huh.
And I am a big believer that half the responsibility of being an artist is you've got to figure out a way how you can be creative.
Mm-hmm.
And being creative means you have to be curious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how to create a creative environment for yourself is personal for every single
sure.
person.
Sure.
And this is my way.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so how much time do you spend in each place?
I try to get up to Taos about every 6 weeks, every 2 months. And it's quite a drive. It's
yeah.
13 hours, 725 miles. So it's 10 days to 2 weeks.
That you're staying.
But I do it so often instead of one extended period is I want a sense of living there. I mean,
mm-hmm.
when I did landscapes, I would go travel all over these great places, but I was just looking at things.
Right.
This way, I want it to be more a part, you know, my neighborhoods,
mm-hmm.
Of understanding the climate, understanding the culture.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems to have more depth to me.
Right.
This episode of Paper Talk is sponsored by the Red Cliff Paper Retreat, an annual retreat held at Helen Hebert's studio in the heart of the Rocky Mountains of Colorado. Enjoy 3 to 6 peaceful creative days in the tiny hamlet of Red Cliff, the weekend after Labor Day, surrounded by mountains, the river, and aspen trees as they begin to change their glorious fall colors. Experiment with several techniques as you create a variety of paper objects that will intrigue your eyes and illuminate your spirit. All levels of art experience are welcome. The 2018 retreat theme is illuminated paper. Come explore a variety of papers that are inherently transparent, discover ways to make paper translucent, and create structures that lend themselves to being illuminated, such as screens, lamps, lanterns, window treatments, and books. Explore these ideas as you create unique paper objects with like-minded people. Find out more at helenhebertstudio.com/redcliffpaperretreat. That's HELENHIEBERT studio.com/redcliffpaperretreat.
I'd love for you to tell us about commission from beginning to end, sort of how.
Okay, it starts with you get an inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
And an art consultant will email you. If you've never worked with that particular person, they'll give you a call probably first.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you've worked with them a bunch, they'll send you an email and they say, I have this job.
Mm-hmm.
And they often won't say the specific name of it. They'll say it's a restaurant
right.
or it's a hospital. Or, you know, it's a private residence, you know. And they say, we've seen on a website, and
mm-hmm.
I feel a website for any artist is an absolute must.
Yes.
Okay. They'll have seen what I have on my website, and they'll say, we're looking at something like this style, because
mm-hmm.
I do different types of
right.
work. And they will want to know right off the price range.
Uh-huh.
So I feel you have to get back ASAP.
Yeah.
I try to do it within 24 hours with the price because they're sitting there forming a budget. The
right.
way they work is you might be a one-shot thing for them or they might be working with you know, hundreds, if not 1,000 pieces of art, and they're trying to put their puzzle piece together, their budget. And if you wait too long, and don't respond right away, then you're out of the cut.
They've spent their budget.
Okay.
Yeah.
So right now, for instance, I'm pending on probably five different ones.
Uh-huh.
Probably only one or two of those will come through.
Mm-hmm.
They usually don't tell you when you don't get the final one.
Uh-huh.
You just sort of, it goes into never, never land, okay? And you forget about it. There's one that I thought was never, never land, and I had put in a proposal 3-4 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I'm in the final cut.
I found out
a couple months ago. Wow. I'm still in the final cut, and I just thought it was off, okay? So these right now for me are from all over the country. One in L.A., one in St. Louis, one in Chicago, one here in Austin, and there's another one. Oh, one in El Paso. Okay.
And these are all through people you've cultivated relationships, or do you ever just see something and it sort of
they're people I have worked with, every single one of these, okay? But as I said, the companies change.
Right.
Sure. But they sort of know what my work looks like, and I've proven that I make my deadlines. I always make my deadlines.
Sure.
Like I said, I respond with prices, what they need. And if I have questions, this is just the difference. I mean, when I realized in the beginning, you know, I didn't realize, but I have to if I'm going to have two studios, you know. I have to be a businesswoman.
Oh, of course.
Okay, and this is what business people do.
Yes, right.
Okay.
You make your deadlines.
You have to make your deadlines, and you act professional and don't make excuses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you get idiots, and there are several art consultants I will no longer work with anymore. Okay, but for the most part, they're wonderful because they come to you because they. You can make something for them they need.
Right. You're solving their problem.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're solving their problem.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of relationships where, of course, I've never met these people, but I have these phone conversation relationships. And over the years, occasionally, circumstances have had them come to Austin or Taos, and I've actually met them for real. Uh-huh. It's very strange.
Uh-huh.
It's exciting, and I like the idea that it's more national than just local. Mm-hmm. That fits something that I feel comfortable with.
Right. Yeah. And so you're at the point then where you're. What have you submitted as a proposal?
Oh, okay.
A sketch.
So sometimes
I know
they want a sketch.
Your...
Sometimes they just sort of are very. Vague. We want it to look like this piece, but we want it in this color palette.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And then they also want to know how soon can they have it.
Uh-huh.
And this is something I've learned the hard way, is I'll give them a projected time frame saying after I receive the deposit.
Which is 50%?
And the deposit is, I always ask for 50%. Uh-huh. And that is because they will put it off.
Sure.
And then they said, but you could have, you said 6 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And they've given you 2 weeks to do it. And you said, no, I haven't received the deposit yet.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then you begin on it.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, sometimes it's a mad rush because I'm in the middle of something. When it gets really tricky is when you've got 3 or 4 of these all at the same time, and you said, you know, 6 weeks, 2 months to everybody. You know, it's insane.
Yeah.
But it's invigorating, too.
Do you ever hire someone to help you?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes I have to.
Sure. Sure.
I don't have anybody on a regular basis, depending on the situation.
Mm-hmm. And then is there any interim, like, check-in, or is it just the piece
done? Well, usually I do, if I haven't worked with them very much before, I'll give them progress photos.
Uh-huh.
Thank goodness for, you know, cameras on phones and iPads now. All of this is so much better before with digital than it used to be when you had to do slides and things. It's such a liberation. But checking in, keeping people posted, because if there's any misunderstanding, it's much better to get it corrected beforehand.
Sure.
So then when it's finished, mm-hmm. then you send them a finished photo of the piece, mm-hmm. and you wait for a final okay.
Uh-huh.
Don't ever send a finished piece without a final okay.
Right.
Then I always make my own crates.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and a lot of artists hire it out,
mm-hmm.
but since I do so much all over the country, I think one of the reasons people do come back and work with me is I don't do a ridiculous shipping rate. Basically, I pick up the cost of making the crate, and I have them pick up the shipping cost.
Uh-huh.
And I usually use FedEx Ground.
Uh-huh.
And I will often, they'll want an estimate beforehand for the shipping when that proposal happens. I sort of know generally how much things are. But if it's too much or if it's more than we talked about, I send them a copy of the FedEx bill.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I ship it, then I email them a final bill. Invoice
mm-hmm.
for the balance.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, they will not get around to sending the check. So then you keep on sending them email
invoice
bills pointing out.
Yep.
And if you don't hear for a while, then you can say, when might I expect the final? Okay.
Right.
With the commissions, they're running the business also.
Right.
They understand.
Yeah.
So.
Sure. Yeah, and it is. You pay for something you buy. I mean, it's the normal transaction. So you have interesting hardware for hanging pieces. I want to just talk a little bit about how you approach that, because most of your pieces hang on the wall. And also framing or not framing, because paper is not permanent, and that's always an issue.
It's always an issue, and I personally, except sometimes when I do flat collages, they're okay in a frame, but I usually think a frame makes a piece look like it's caged.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of my work has to go into some, it's called high traffic areas,
mm-hmm.
basically restaurants and hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where I'm very lucky that I actually like to use acrylic on my paper versus the pigment in the pulp.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the reasons I make my own paper is I don't put any sizing at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want that paper, if I so desire to add acrylic, to absorb it all the way through.
Right.
I think it can be a beautiful effect with the acrylic in thin washes, not thick,
mm-hmm.
but in thin. But in cases where it needs, it's going to be like in a high traffic area, like in a hallway, in a sitting room, in a hospital, if I know it's in a situation like that, I will, after it's finished, add a layer of matte medium to
mm-hmm.
the surface that will give it a coating.
Do you water that down too, or is it straight?
I don't water that down because it's got to, basically, they've got to be able to sponge it.
So that's how you recommend they clean
yes,
it?
Yes, no cleaning agents.
A damp sponge.
Yeah. But some of these, with the acrylic, with the thin washes, that doesn't mean I do a thin wash. Maybe it's 1 to 5 parts water, 1 part acrylic.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that's one coat. Then I let it dry. Then I do another coat.
Right.
You know, and I can get some just beautiful effects
mm-hmm.
by continually sort of pouring these washes over the
mm-hmm.
acrylic, and it goes in to the fibers, and eventually, if you have enough of it, it's sort of interspersed between
mm-hmm.
the spaces between
mm-hmm.
the fibers.
So you just mentioned pouring. I was going to ask you about application. Do you brush on? Do you pour?
Oh,
do you
dip? I mix my paint in my blender, believe it
okay.
or not. And I put it in jugs, empty water jugs, or in bowls. And I put the paper on the floor on plastic, and I just start pouring it. And then why I often do abaca is... because I can lift it up. It can be really wet, and it can have a color on it. I can pick it up, and I can blot it onto a different color. And they're both so wet, they'll both start bleeding the other color into each other.
Right.
And it's just such an exhilarating, you know, time, because all these colors are blending and blotting and flowing and stuff. And then you just have to let it dry.
Right.
And then when you peel it off, you know, the next day or however long it takes, you know, it sort of comes off with this fabulous physical sensation and sound. And you really don't know. Sometimes the back side looks better than the front side.
Sure.
You know, and it's... There's so many steps that are so exciting.
Yeah.
such a high. Okay. So.
Awesome. Well, I know you work with glass too, but I think we're kind of out of time. So
okay,
It's
another whole thing.
We'll put pictures on the website and links to your website. And
okay.
Just, what's your favorite paper or paper making tool or
something? I need my Hollander beater and my paper cutter. I love my paper cutter. And I realized...
Just like
in school.
Right.
I realized when I decided to be an artist full time, the very first thing I bought was my paper cutter. Okay. And I was doing paintings then, but I still had to have my paper cutter.
Right.
You know, now I'm just doing paper, and I use my paper cutter all the time.
So how do you use it?
Well, rolls, okay.
Cutting strips.
Getting my abaca into my beater, you know, so it will fit before I start, you know,
Have you found the best paper cutter, or is it...
I still have that same one.
Just the same
one. And I take it about once a year to the knife sharpener, and the guy said, what a paper cutter. It has character, you know.
Right.
And when I have had open studios in here, a lot of people just look at my paper cutter. And, of course, it's grown with me, so I just, you know, think... And I have one in Taos, too, of course.
Is it large? Is it like 2 feet?
Yeah, it's 24 inches.
Both of them were 24 inches.
Now, the one in Taos, I had visited Catherine Nash's studio in Tucson, and I thought it was so clever because Catherine has everything she can imagine on wheels, on cartwheels. You know, you can roll around.
Right.
So that's what I did with my paper cutter in Taos, and it really is handy having a paper cutter on, you know, on a trolley.
Yes.
Because you can move it to where you want to be instead of you always walking over to it.
Right. Cool. Okay, well, this has been a delight, Priscilla.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay updated is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio in Colorado. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you listen to the podcast on a regular basis, you'll notice I've done a bit more editing than usual. This is thanks to the help of Gary A. Hansen. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about Gary and his services. Subscribe to this series via iTunes. You can also leave a review. I'd appreciate that. And listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon.
There's a reason.